Welcome to It's Your Break. Sit down, relax, and take a break.
Have you ever went somewhere where maybe a family member or somebody has asked you to go pick something up and you're supposed to meet somebody who you've never met before? And you've got to try to pick them out of a crowd of people. And you see that one person that starts walking toward you. And you're like, no, that's probably not them. Because what you're picturing in your mind wouldn't fit the person that you're imagining. How would you like to have that happen on a daily basis? Our guest coming up on the show, who is a doctor and behavioral analyst, has that happen to him quite often. His story is pretty incredible, and what he does is even more incredible. And it's coming up next on It's Your Break. At Shore Shooters, beach photography is our specialty. It's all we do. Our experienced, fun photographers are the best at capturing your vacation memories as they happen. It's real life, candid, and fun, not just posed portraits. And we're not just isolated to one beach. We are in the Alabama Gulf Coast with Dolphin Island, Gulf Shores, and Orange Beach, the Florida Panhandle, Tampa Bay area beaches, Sarasota, Fort Myers, and Hilton Head, South Carolina. To learn more about us, see our pricing options, meet our photographers, see samples of our works, read reviews from our clients, or to schedule your beach photography session, go to shoreshooters.com. That's shoreshooters.com, or call us at 866-856-2435. So what are you waiting for? Go online to shoreshooters.com and schedule your session, and let us help you make memories that last a lifetime. Welcome to It's Your Break. Hi, I'm Jonathan Mertz, and if you ever think about behavior, you usually think about either good behavior or bad behavior, but I have a feeling it's more complex than that. So I'm bringing on a doctor, not just any doctor, a doctor who has looked through the microscope of the human personality. Somebody who's actually just kind of went around and just molded his entire business around the human behavior. Dr. Antonio Harrison, PhD, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate you having me, man. It's an honor to be here.
You, when we were kind of talking before we got on this show, you're one of the people who kind of fascinate me, because when you see Dr. Antonio Harrison and you see the name and then you see your picture, you're like, that's not really what I pictured. You know, when you see a name first in print, you're like, what is this person? What would they look like? And then you see a person's actual, you know, face expression. And you're like, that's not typically what I was thinking. I was thinking of somebody more cut, had this nice clean suit on, who was very, very, you know, very nerdy looking. And you look nothing like that.
No, it's one of the things I use to my advantage, that I love to see people's expressions switch up. You know, I got tattoos up and down my arms, bald head. I like suits, but I hate ties. I'm me. You know, I coach high school football as well, so usually I'm in some sort of athletic gear because I'm coming from practice or going to the weight room for the boys. I give off exactly who I am and not try to be anybody else.
Have you ever went into a public speaking thing? You just went with a t-shirt, jeans, and, you know, you kind of got your tattoos and go sit in the audience, and then they call you up? Like I call your name and you just walk on the stage and freak everybody out?
Never that, but I did give a talk once to a bunch of high school kids on the idea of how others perceive you, and I start out in a full suit, and by the time I'm done with my talk, I walk into the back and come back out with basketball shorts, a tank top on, and a ball cap and some slippers, just to let them know, you know, had I came out like this at first, would you have listened to me the way you listened to me in the beginning, right? Perception, you know, people perceive things within an instant. So, but I love it. Whenever I get to go somewhere and introduce myself, you always see it in people's faces. No one's expecting that's the guy, that's Dr. Harris.
That's exactly what I was thinking. you know, like, whoa, that's pretty interesting. But, you know, I'd rather have more doctors that look like you than the other very, you know, these very lab coaty kind of look. I mean, some people just have that perception of, oh, they can't, you know, if they don't look like that, they can't treat you. And some of them lack the personality to be able to relate. Right. And to me, that's what makes good doctors to me. It doesn't always mean the person is going to have all the best answers. Even the other doctor who looks the part is not going to have all the answers. But somebody who can truly relate to you is where I found more comfort.
Now, that's what I definitely pride myself on. And you know, again, used to my advantage is that I look like you. I sound like you. I act like you. I am you, the people that I serve. I'm not someone who's sitting on top of the hill with a suit and a nice car who hasn't experienced what you're going through every day in life. I'm going through it myself, you know, and I want to make sure people understand that so they know that I'm coming from a place that they've come from or that they are currently in.
Before we get onto more of what being a behavior analyst is, can we talk about, you know, how you got onto this path? Because like I said, and we've mentioned this already, you don't look the part what people normally think of when they hear doctor.
Yeah, sure.
How did you fall down this path? Where did you come from? What was your background? How did you fall on this path?
Well, it kind of happened before school. As a kid, I was always really observant and watching people. And part of that was because of my upbringing. I grew up in a lower socioeconomic status. We didn't, you know, there were times where we were eating ramen for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And around the age of 10, I found out my dad was addicted to crack cocaine, and the crack epidemic in the 80s in Los Angeles hit our family really hard. I mean, I had experiences that no kid should have where, you know, my dad driving to go cop some dope and then pulling over off the freeway at a, you know, public park, going into the bathroom to use for 2.5 hours, leaving his 12-year-old son in the car, or pawning my Christmas gifts on December 26th, or, you know, using in the house and then seeing him down in the living room holding a butcher knife, looking, peering out the windows, paranoid, high on drugs. And the crazy thing was, even through all of that, we were really close. He was my best friend. And part of it was because he was super honest. He owned his shortcomings. He held himself accountable. And he never lied to me. So it allowed me to say, you know, wow, for him to, for that drug to overcome the amount of love he has for me, because I see him show that love for me, it's not that he's a bad person. That drug's got a hold of him. And when it's got a hold of him, nothing else matters. And then seeing my mom work 2 and 3 jobs to hold us together, because at that point, my dad wasn't working anymore. And my sister, since she was younger, she got kind of left in the wing a little bit. And, you know, I was doing my own thing. And so I ended up, you know, always being interested in just people watching all the time. I was just telling someone the other day, I went to a James Taylor concert at the Hollywood Bowl. And though I love James Taylor, the number two thing I enjoyed the most was just watching all the people move around. And so when I got to undergrad out in Iowa, Grinnell College, I played football out there, and I had plans to go and play professionally. And if that didn't work, I had a nice job lined up at a nonprofit I had worked at over the summer, and I was going to stay in the Midwest. But my senior year, you know, after being a 4-year starter and, you know, freshman college athlete of the year and all conference, inside of my ankle touched my groin. No one hit me. It was just a bad fall. And I was casted hip to toe for 8 months. It took me about a year and a half to walk again. So I had to come home because I needed people to help me, you know, just shower. And while I was at home, I was teaching elementary school, you know, regular 5 days a week. I was working graveyard shift at 24-hour fitness 3 days of the week. And I was a bouncer at a club on Saturdays and Fridays. And I was just burning the candle at both ends, man. And I was like, you know, I've always enjoyed school. Maybe I should go back to school. And I reached out to my undergrad professor, David Lopato, who was this real monotone, you know, just random guy who told these off the wall jokes that no one really got. But I thought he was hilarious. And I loved his class because he would always make us go out into the school, do things in the environment to see how people react, observe and measure. And so when I called him up, he said, hey, take a look at behavior analysis. This might be of interest to you because you like to observe and measure so much. And sure enough, I did, and found a grad school that, you know, was going to work with me as a working adult. So I went to grad school while working full time, coaching high school football as a head varsity football coach. My first and my second son came along while I was in grad school. So, you know, it was just a lot. And even after that, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. But as I was, my third child came along, and I was looking around and seeing, wait a minute, I've got 3 boys. I had a really rough childhood, but I'm real close to my dad. I coach high school boys. I love to teach. I love to work with people. and I can help because of my life experience and education, hell, I need to start working with fathers and sons and parents in general, because that's the only thing I ever wanted to be growing up outside of was a pro athlete, was a dad, a good dad. That was it. So it all just kind of lined up, but I didn't know it was going to line up until that third boy was born.
That's so interesting, because, you know, you hear some people who get into the actual area when you hear about it becoming a behavioral analyst. You don't usually hear about it, okay, let's go help fathers, sons. You hear about it associated with the FBI. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of interesting. I was like, what, did he ever consider going to work for the FBI, or even think it was a possibility? Was it ever in his mindset?
Law and Order is one of my favorite shows of all time. I watch that anytime it's on. So, you know, thoughts like that cross my mind, but a lot of people in our field too work with, populations with children with autism and Asperger's. And I tried some of that stuff, but one of the big things that at the time I thought was holding me back, but actually worked in my favor, was I wasn't willing to give up coaching football. So all the jobs I took, I would tell them, hey, when football season comes around, you know, my hours got to be cut because I'm not giving that up. And everybody would agree. And then once football season came around, they wouldn't be willing to cut hours. So I would leave. So it wasn't because of that football, it forced me to start doing things on my own and kind of creating my own niche and carving my own path, which I'm super grateful for, because I love coaching high school boys. It's one of the best things I think I do outside of what I do.
That is cool. So let's talk about behavioral analysis. And what is the whole science of a behavioral analysis? Is it like social psychology? What is it?
So behavior analysis is the science of human behavior. And we consider ourselves a hard science because we only deal with things that are observable and measurable. I see it, I can count it, right? So that's the big difference away from the other branches of psychology. I'm not trying to assume what's going on in your head. I'm not talking about the id or the ego or anything like that. I can give you an example. You can tell me, hey, Dr. Harrison, I need some help or some advice. My friend's depressed. What can I do? Now, if you go in and you get diagnosed with depression, what's the first thing most psychiatrists do? They prescribe a drug, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they do. For me, I'm saying, I don't know what you're talking about depression. Tell me what they're doing. Well, they stay in their room all day, eat tubs of ice cream, and isolate themselves. All things I can see and I can count. Well, I'm going to get them out of their room. We're going to get them a good meal and put them around people who enjoy them to bring smile and laughter. All things you can see and count, right? So that's my whole thing. If I can see it and I can count it, we can change it. Even if it's something like thinking or emotions inside, it's attached to something else in the environment. You don't work separate from your environment. It all works together, man. Like, no one's walking around here completely separate from everything that's going on in the world. Everything's a part of everything. So that's the big difference, making sure I can see it and I can count it. Not really worried about trying to figure out what's going on inside your head, because the only way I can figure that out is by you telling me. And let's be honest, most people lie, exaggerate, tell the truth, do all kind of stuff, you know?
Right. And you know what's truly fascinating about this is I read an article, and I didn't get to read the book, I got to read the article, about a study that was done with heroin and with the psychology behind some of the aspects of how people reacted in certain environments. They started out with rats, and then they did it later with humans. And one of the things that they noticed was, if you had a rat in isolation, they gave him a tub of water or a drip of water, like one of those little hamster, I guess, water feeder things, and then another one that was laced with heroin. And they found out, if they were isolated, they kept going back to that one over and over and over and over. But once they got that social involvement, that thing barely ever got touched, if at all.
Right.
Because they found people who gave them that support and reacted. And one of the things that, and it makes sense too, is like, you know, one of the purest forms of heroin is morphine, and people don't realize that. And hospitals use it all the time, but people don't come out truly addicted to heroin right after a single use of morphine or a quick stint in the hospital. You know, it's usually a prolonged experience and it's a series of downfalls. And then they looked into people's lives who are addicted but married and or together with a person. And one of the things that they saw was they weren't really together. They were separate.
Yeah, now my parents, even though they lived in the same house, stayed married. They were just roommates. That's what it was. Even, and just to your point about the hospital, when I had my surgery on my knee the first time, which was four surgeries in a night for 12 and a half hours on the cutting table, I was given something called hydromorphone, which is some derivative of morphine that was extremely powerful. But I didn't come out with any problems with it. It wasn't until they gave me pills while I was back at college that it was like one of my friends had to be like, hey, you know, I know you're in pain and you're casted hip to toe, but you might want to take it easy on that stuff, right? Because at that point, I was all alone. And I mean, think about all the shows you see, Intervention.
Right.
It's the main reason where once someone agrees to go to rehab, they send you to a different location. So you don't have all those same triggers in your environment that got you using or kept you using in the first place.
You know, I used to work for the prison system here in the state of Kentucky, and that was one of the things about AA and NA was one way to change yourself is to pull yourself completely out of your environment. In some cases, it has to be really drastic. You can't go back to home to your family. You can't go back to the same neighborhood. You know, well, then they're like, well, how do I going to support? Well, we've got things to help you out if you truly want to take this new path.
Yeah.
You know, and people really, the ones that really do take the program seriously. I mean, I've seen a big change in some of them. My uncle who went through AA many years ago has almost been sober for over 35 years now. So, you know, for the people who truly want it for themselves and are willing to go with it, I mean, it makes a huge difference in their lives. Some people do it because they're pressured into it. And for me, like when I was looking at the prison things, one of the stipulations is like, oh, if you want to get early release or something, go take NAAA, you know, and they think that just by them taking it, they're going to get some benefit. No, they've got to want to take it. And that's something that with anything, it's like a diet, you know, that I see with people. If you're going, it's like, I want to lose weight. I want to do this. I want to work out. Unless you make it a commitment in your mind, and then two, you have a social support, then you're not going to have, you know, any results.
No, I mean, it was blatantly obvious with my dad. He's been in and out of jail, the prison system, since he was 12 years old. And all throughout my life, he would, you know, go to jail, get cleaned up, come home and go right back to using again. It wasn't until, you know, we grew up going to visit him in the prison inside jail. And it wasn't until I had my kids and I told them, look, I love you. I'll correspond with you. I'll take your phone calls, but my kids will never step foot in the jail to come see you. So you can either change this and switch this, or when you're in there by yourself, know that your grandkids are no longer going to have a granddad at that moment, because I don't want them to experience what I did. And it was kind of the turning point for him to realize I've had a lot of unconditional love and support from my family. And for the first time, we're finally growing as an extended family, and I don't want to miss out on that. And so, you know, since the last time he's been home over about 2.5-3 years ago, you know, he's finally clean, which is great because my kids love him to death.
Well, that's awesome. That's cool. It you know, it's just amazing how much support, whether it's with a religious organization and people there, or if it's with your home, a psychologist, you know, that anywhere you can find that support, how much it makes a huge difference in somebody's lives. And sometimes it's just people wanting somebody else to listen to them. You know, and that's the big thing too, that I didn't realize until later in life, because my aunt had raised many foster kids, and I didn't realize that a lot of them, you know, just needed somebody that they can lean on, and they turned right around. And it was just amazing to once you realize what was going on, because a lot of it was, you know, when I was younger, it was hidden from me, and as I got older, you know, my aunt and uncle explained things to me, it's just amazing, because to me, those kids were just my friends. You know, they weren't just, you know, I was like, you know, sometimes I'm like, why they come and go so fast? But my to give credit to my aunt and uncle, I don't know how they did it, but they've had over 200 and something foster kids.
Wow.
Out of those 200 of them, they ended up adopting six.
Nice.
So
that's amazing.
Yeah. It's one of those things that you're like, oh wow. And you know, when I go to their house, because I'm a Caucasian white male, and you go to their house and they're white, but their kids are Hispanic and black and white, and you know, you got a whole mixture of races just within that entire household, and none of them are treated different. They're all right. treated equals, and they're all, you know, loved unconditionally by my aunt and uncle. So so just those things, and hearing some of these kids as they graduate school, they're starting to graduate school now. One of them's already in college. Well, two of them already graduated. Third one will be graduating soon from her adopted children. She has one biological child, and it's just, you know, it's amazing how they come to her and tell her, you know, we're grateful for this, because she didn't get it when they were babies. You know, they came right. into their lives, you know, when they were, you know, maybe just about 10 or just a little under 10, you know, in the most cases. So it's amazing to hear their stories.
Well, see, and that's the great thing too. I mean, the bottom line, what it's all about in terms of getting the best out of people, in terms of their behavior, is love and consistency, man. Like, you got to be consistent. You know, that support your aunt was providing was consistent for them. It was probably the first time they ever had consistency in their life, right? And so whether it's good or bad, something that's good for you or bad for you, if you're consistent with it, you're going to be pretty damn good at it.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. Right? So kind of getting back to what you do, and this is me and my completely ADD warped mind. Looking at behavioral analysis and hearing you describe what you do makes me think that you're a professional stalker, and you know, in a good way, not a bad way, because you're one of those people that can see from afar and just you don't really have to hear the conversation. You know what they're thinking. You see the mannerisms. You know what they're going through. You can just tell. You know, they're drooping their shoulders a little bit, you know, as they, you know, lean to the right or something, or to the left. And you notice that you either, okay, they may be in pain that way, or maybe they're experiencing loss, you know, things that I see for myself too, but I've never went into your depth of really being observant on it and really just kind of thriving on it. But there's things that I pick up on, you know, you figure out body languages. In the years I've done interviews, you know, you see how people are reacting to you. For me, I can listen to an audio as people are talking and feel how they're engaging with me. You know, you got to get in those cues and find out exactly where those tweaks are. In a way, you almost kind of think, for me, when you start looking at, you know, all these different little shows that deal with crime and drama, you're like, how would Batman do this? Because he's a very good observer. You know, that's what he does. He, you know, he does stalk around, you know, criminals that he profiles, you know, he watches them, he understands them, he tries to get in every aspect of their life. And that's more of, like, you know, along the behavioral analysis for the FBI too, but yours is more environmental, of trying to find a better place for somebody. And that's what I really
better place, and just getting them to do better things, right? Like, anytime I tell someone what I do, I'm a behavior analyst or a behavior scientist, you know, they always joke like, oh, should I be watching myself? Are you analyzing me? And My real response, or at least what I'm thinking, is, one, I'm not on the clock, right? Two, if I'm seeing somebody and I see something or observe something to where I know I can help, I don't approach that person. Let's say, for example, I see someone that looks like maybe they just had a really rough day. I don't approach that person as a behavior analyst and say, here, I'm this professional expert who can help you in this and that. I just approach them as a person. You doing okay? Everything all right? If the conversation switched gears towards that, then great. I can understand what I'm doing and how my mind's working and how my education is showing itself to me in terms of understanding what's going on with this person. But there's no need for me to make that person feel judged, to feel analyzed, anything like that. They just need to feel like a person at that moment. You know what I mean? Right. So it's hard to turn off sometimes. And quite frankly, I don't even know if I can, because I'm always looking and seeing things. But I enjoy it, so it doesn't bother me. And because I don't throw it in people's face in some sort of condescending way with all this technical jargon from psychology, and I just talk to people, it's crazy the response I get. My wife will tell me all the time, like, you know, you just stepped out for a few minutes. Why were you gone for 25 minutes? And I was like, she's like, was someone talking to you? He's like, yep, because people end up telling me things that you just met me. There's no reason I need to know, you know, why you had hemorrhoids at 55. Like, you know, but it's I just see something and I make a comment as a person first before I make it as any kind of professional.
That's a really smart move because you're not falling in that typical line of the, especially comedic jokes, and comedians will talk about this about, you know, their girlfriends or somebody start taking psychology classes and everything they do, they start to examine everything they do. It's like, I've read about this. I know exactly what you're doing. You're going out, you're messing around on me, blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's not that you're still trying, even though you can't always turn everything off, because to be honest, it's always been there even before you were
a
behavioral analyst. And it, for you, it's always going to be there as an observer. And, you know, comedians are one of the biggest observers of all time. And I was going to ask you, do you ever try to think about going down that direction? Because, I mean, that is their number one thing, is observing the world, but not always seeing it like everybody else sees it.
No, I think I'm pretty damn funny myself. My wife doesn't think so at times, but no, I could never do comedy. One of my real close friends, one of my best friends, he actually tried it for a stint, and I thought, like, oh, maybe I can do that if he could do it. But no, I like my lane, coach my football, deal with parents, fathers, sons, help people change, you know, their behavior and their environment. And, you know, that's me. I'm cool with that. I'll sit back and laugh at the comedians. I don't know if I could do that. They're pretty brave for getting up there and trying to cheer people up and make them laugh. It's a hard thing to do.
Well, and you know what's weird is a lot of times we're laughing at their own problems.
Right.
You know, because comedians, like, people are like, how are you so funny and stuff like that? But if you actually listen to truly what they're saying and you break it down into a non-comedic and you just put it on paper of how, you know, what they truly, and kind of look at the punchlines, not in such a big way, and kind of just look at the true details of the situation. A guy goes out, he's big, he's fat, they say something funny to him, or what we think would be funny, but if you look at it in the real manner, how was that addressed in that situation? How did he truly feel in that situation?
You know, exactly.
You know, people don't think about that, but, you know, like, oh, you're laughing, you're having a good time, like, oh, that's funny, you know, because Gabriel Iglesias is one of my favorite comedians, and you hear him talk about how he goes out, and he's in his little bug, and he's, you know, he's a big guy, everybody knows he's a big guy, he even makes mention several times throughout every episode he has ever or every show he's ever had that he's a big guy, and and you know, you hear he's driving this little Volkswagen bug, okay, yeah, big guy in a little car, that in itself, you know, can seem funny to other people, and he makes light of it, but he may like that car, and then somebody else points out, hey, you know, look at there, the Fat and the Furious, you know, and all that stuff, you know, but, you know, how did he really truly feel the first time he heard that? You know, was it somebody he always cut up with and he was okay, you know? But people don't really, when you hear these stories from comedians, there's a underlying story that's not really there that they don't tell the people. They just tell the people the story because they know it got a laugh somewhere, or they may have thought it was funny after the fact, but you know,
that underlying story is usually full of pain, honestly.
Yes. Yes. Cat Williams says comedy comes from a dark place.
Yes.
You know, and it does in most cases. I mean, everything that you deal with, in other cases, it just comes from those awkward moments. You know, it's really what it is. But it's just fascinating how observant they are in what you do, and how they almost kind of look like they intertwine, you know, for different reasons, but they intertwine. So, but it was, Dr. Antonio, it's so amazing to talk to you. And I want people to be able to look you up and find more information on you. And where can they go to do that?
Definitely. They can check out the website at rebirthbx.com. So that's REBIRTHB as in boy, X as in x-ray.com. I'm on social media. Everything is at rebirthbx. Even on my website, you can be able to contact me directly through my cell phone. I'm open and accessible to anybody who wants help, because I learn from them just as much as they learn from me.
Gotcha. What, real quick, what does the X stand for on the end of that? Because I guess the B is,
in psychological shorthand, if you put BX, that stands for behavior.
Okay, gotcha. I figured it had something to do with behavior. I just wanted to make sure and say, like, okay, I know what RX is, like a prescription. Like,
right.
This is almost like BX. But it's just something interesting that I wanted to point out. If anybody else is what is that BX for? I mean, it's really weird that he meant to put an R there. You know.
Now you're actually the first person to ever actually ask that question who doesn't know. You know what I mean?
Right.
So kudos to you for being willing to ask a question, man.
I will ask questions all day. That's what I do. So, you know, and so, but yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Antonio Harrison, for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
You too, man. I really appreciate it. And I hope I can help out anyone who would like it. And thank you again for having me on. It was a blast, man.
Thanks again to our sponsor, Shore Shooters, for helping us out.
It's Your Break is owned and distributed by Spark of Vision. And follow us on Twitter @ItsYourBreak.